Welcome to the Sidcast. This is Sid Finkelstein, and I'm delighted to be with you again today. Today, we are going to be talking about invention, and talking about inventions with one of the world's most prolific inventors, and extremely relevant to pretty much what everyone here listening either has or is listening to on that device right now, Eric Fossum. There are three things I want to say by way of introduction. Number one, parents, this might be of interest to you. Eric Fossum got his kind of the spark started from this Saturday program he did on math and science. He even says it changed his life, and he started to learn about coding that he ended up doing in college. And all of that is under the category of let's call it experiential learning, as opposed to maybe traditional book learning. Experiential learning is learning by doing, and it turns out that, as Eric Fossum is going to explain in our conversation, creating free time for your kids to just kind of explore, to do, not have them in constant after school programs and little time with friends, and of course you spend time with your friends, but leave them alone sometimes. It's okay. It's not a bad thing. You know, I was visiting my my niece and my great niece, who is 6 years old, not that long ago, and the adults were all talking or having dinner or whatever, and she was just playing off by herself on the side, and comes back with this beautiful drawing and a whole idea. She comes to me and she says, "You know, Uncle Sid, let's make a dictionary." Now, you know, where does this stuff come from? It's by leaving a kid alone. With some tools, with some supervision, maybe, but with an opportunity to create something. Call that experiential learning. So parents, put that closer to the top of the list. Let's stop programming our kids as much as we do. Number two, creativity. So much of the Sidcast is about creativity. I'm fascinated by it. I love it. And one of the things Eric Fossum tells us today is that every one of us, by our nature, by the fact that we are human, are inventors. We're naturally creative. And that's something we probably forget. A lot of people probably think, well, you're either born creative or you're not born creative. But I don't think that's right. And Eric Fossum makes a strong case about how each of us are inventors. And every day we're inventing something, we're creating something. It's not like somebody gives you a list of things to do from the morning you wake up to the minute you wake up to the minute you go to sleep, and you go through the list and say, okay, now I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that, I'm going to follow a roadmap. Along the way, we improvise, we create, we adjust, and that's what invention is to some extent. Big part of it is obviously trying and failing and not being afraid to do that. That's something we've talked about before, and we'll talk about it again with Eric Fossum. But creativity, everyone listening to this, well, yes, you are creative. Eric Fossum told you so. And then number three, well, what did Eric Fossum do that makes him so famous? Well, this is a guy that, you know, he was at Caltech, he worked for NASA, and he invented certain technologies used in cameras. And when I say used in cameras, I mean used in cameras. I ask him, as you'll hear, you know, how many products or devices out there have your technology built in? And his answer is something like, in the billions. Yeah, that's right, B for billion. Because if you have a Samsung phone, an iPhone, lots of other mobile devices, it turns out that the camera technology is something based on his research, his patents, his work along the way. You talk about an impact. And, you know, in 2020, the Mars rover is NASA sending a spaceship to Mars, and the Mars rover is equipped with the CMOS technology, the technology that Eric Fossum created. So Eric Fossum is a member of the National Academy of Inventors. He's a member of the Inventors Hall of Fame. He's won the Exceptional Achievement Medal at NASA, which is really something because the whole place is pretty exceptional. And in 2017, he won the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering. And that is that's also been won, just so you know, by the people that created the World Wide Web. So we're talking about a pretty amazing and interesting and fascinating person. So a great conversation today, relevant for parents, relevant for people who are interested in creativity, and anyone interested in invention. Welcome to the Sidcast, and my guest today is Eric Fossum. Eric, good morning.
Good morning to you.
This could be going on in the afternoon, too, so good afternoon as well. Who knows when somebody's going to be listening. So, Eric, you grew up in Connecticut, and I guess near Hartford. What were your parents about in those days? I mean, what did they do for a living?
Yeah, well, my mom was a mom and housewife, and my dad was a young engineer at that time, working for Pratt & Whitney.
Did he bring home any engineering-type issues or problems for you to kind of get into, given what you ended up doing in your life?
Not so much at that. I'm talking about way back.
Yeah, right.
I do remember, like, using old blueprints as drawing paper for...
Oh, yeah? That was just around the house?
Just around the house, yeah. I guess it was scrap paper or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. But then later, he actually did a startup company. Uh-huh. And doing electromagnetic clutches and brakes. He was a mechanical engineer. And I have a lot of not so fond memories of those days.
Oh, well,
ironically.
May I ask why that is?
Well, let's see. He wound up renting space in the old Collins Axe Factory in Collinsville, Connecticut, which probably hadn't been occupied in 100 years.
Oh, boy.
And guess who got to clean out all the ugly spots in that rental space?
Oh, wow.
So why not?
About chores.
Yeah, and then wiring lights and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then later, actually, a part that I do appreciate, first of all, because it was good to make money, but also it was very very good educational experience, was working on the assembly line, making machining parts.
Really?
And doing things.
How old were you?
Old enough.
Teenager?
I don't want to get him in trouble, but...
it's got to be a statute of limitations for your own child labor.
not quite 16, anyway. But it was pretty interesting doing that repetitive work over and over again. You really last a lifetime just thinking about how you kind of zone out while you're doing that work, but you know, how other workers have to do work. So even when I had my own company years later, I still had that memory. It was still pretty fresh in my mind.
Yeah, and so are you saying that doing the same kind of monotonous work, not an easy way to make a living?
Definitely not an easy way to make a living, but also your life is so much more than your work, which is not the case for a lot of professionals where your life and your work intersect in a very large manner.
Right, that's very interesting because you put in your, I guess, 8 hours or whatever it was, and you haven't put your soul into that work.
That's right.
Because you don't have to.
You're just passing time almost.
Yeah, it's such a different way to think about work, isn't it? Because as you say, so many people, professionals and lots of people, and I talk about work-life balance sometimes, and there is no balance anymore. It's almost like it's the same thing, right?
It certainly feels that way and certainly felt that way this weekend.
What were you doing this weekend?
Oh, working.
Working.
Of course.
So you were, let me ask you this. Do you think that experiences, I guess you can speak to yourself about yourself, but maybe others as well, to the extent that you've either thought about it, talked to people, maybe even looked into it. To what extent do some of these kind of child or early teenage year experiences working, could be with a father, a mother, could be independent, have a long-lasting impact? Because you said, you know, yourself, you still think about, and when you were running your own company, you still think about that kind of monotonous assembly line work, so it must have had an impact.
Yeah, I think it does. I think we don't realize it at the time, but it does carry forward. And another thing I did around the same time is I had a paper route delivering papers.
Really?
Morning papers, which meant getting up before the crack of dawn and delivering them on my bicycle. And I feel like I learned a lot about business during the course of delivering papers and having that paper out.
Well, what was the curriculum? That's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but I certainly appreciate it now, which is that, you know, you have to, at that time, you'd buy the newspapers from the newspaper company, and then you'd have to sell them. You have to go around and try to get new customers so you expand your business. So that means greater market penetration, in a sense, in your neighborhood. Then you have to, of course, deliver the product on time on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of customer relation moments during that process. And especially comes to light when you actually have to collect the money from the customer, which is a whole other adventure when you're a young man, teenager, and people actually, I found, try to avoid paying the paperboy.
Wow.
I mean, it was like 50 cents or something, right?
Right.
So you have to be persistent at collecting money. That's what that comes down to.
Right, which actually is a pretty relevant lesson for anyone.
Exactly. See, it all makes sense.
So maybe that would be an interesting book. You know, what was that book about? Everything I learned about business or about life, I learned in kindergarten. And your version is everything I learned about business, I learned on the paper route.
Yeah, that'd be a good little short story book, I guess.
A short story book. So what type of kid were you? It sounded like you were doing, you know, different jobs. And we were given some chores, and I don't think you grew up in a very affluent household, but probably, I mean, you tell me, was it middle class or?
Yeah, I was, I'd say, lower middle class.
Yeah.
My parents had grown up in New York City and moved out to Connecticut, and they were both product of Depression-era kind of parents themselves. So, you know, they're pretty frugal, and I remember my dad making his first snow shovel out of a piece of plywood and 2x4. Mm. There was a lot of issues that revolved around economy and spending and that sort of thing. And earning money was kind of a basic thing because my parents were going to give me money. And
you had to do it. It was expected.
Right. And even for college, they were... said basically, well, if you want to go to a state school like UConn, you know, we can probably swing that. Mm-hmm. But if you want to go to a fancy school, which I want to go to Trinity College in Hartford, you're going to have to pay for most of that. We're not paying for it.
How old were you when this message was delivered?
Oh, that message was delivered when I was looking at schools.
Okay.
And so pretty close to
right. graduation. But you had been working, paper route, working for your dad, I guess.
Right. Well, I did have this one great experience, and probably because my parents moved to a good school district where I was participating in a Saturday program for, they called it gifted students. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel particularly gifted, but we go up to the Talcott Mountain Science Center in Avon, Connecticut, every Saturday. Mm-hmm. And do all kinds of slightly independent work, research work. Well, not research, deep research, but research from a high schooler's point of view, junior high schooler's point of view. But they also had access to the Dartmouth Timesharing Service, for example, up there in the Talcott Mountain Science Center. And I learned how to do programming in BASIC using an old teletype and...
You were an early coder? Is that what I'm hearing?
I was a very early coder. I could have been Bill Gates if I just pushed myself a little harder.
Could have been.
That was great. And then so the day I turned 16, I was offered a job with a software company, small time-sharing software company in Avon. And when I came around to looking for colleges because of this need to pay, I looked at Trinity because it was within commuting distance of where I was already working and getting paid quite well compared to my friends who were washing dishes or doing other jobs. Mm-hmm. And so I stayed, and probably I would bet, the only person at that college who had a computer terminal in their dormitory room so I could work from my dorm room remotely.
What time period are we at?
It would be like 1975, 1976.
And the IBM PC came out in 1980 or 82?
Yeah, much later, yeah.
Yeah, and Apple came up. Apple was around by 75 or 76? This was the time of the, what did they call those hobby kits?
Yeah, those little hobby kits, Altair and other little...
So you had a terminal, like a dumb terminal?
I had a dumb terminal, CRT terminal, which was very fancy those days. Mm-hmm. And it was connected remotely to a time-sharing service, which we might call the cloud now. But
Now, how did they do that? This was a completely different era, through phone lines, I guess.
That's right. You'd call up on your phone, and plug the phone into some rubber sockets that was part of the modem, and then using audio, essentially, the digital information would be exchanged between the computer, which was many miles away, and the terminal.
So I remember those early days of call-up that you'd connect and you hear these sounds, right, and then bzzz or something and all kinds of staticky sounds. And
yeah, there were a lot of bings and bongs. And
bings and bongs happening, right? Boy, that must sound weird to younger people listening to this who are, you know, on their iPhones, which we'll get to soon enough as well. Yeah, so what did you do with that that terminal in your...
I was writing business software for...
as part of your job.
As part of my job for inventory tracking and sales tracking and that sort of thing.
Wow.
For a couple of small businesses.
And could you or did you imagine what type of future would happen in computers? Did you have any inkling? Because you were there in your pretty early days and we're in a lot of others.
Yeah, actually, I was very interested in... artificial intelligence, still called artificial intelligence in those days.
Really?
And there was a lot of interesting work going on at MIT, and I just tried to do my own coding to try to emulate the same results that these famous researchers at MIT were doing for programs like ELIZA and other learning programs and things that would sort of give the illusion that you were talking to somebody, but it was a very kind of predictable response based on cues you would give it in the words you would type.
So maybe you could say a little bit more about that. I'm curious. I mean, what qualified as, quote, artificial intelligence in 1975? What did it mean?
Yeah, so there was and still is something called a Turing test, which is basically if you put a wall up between you and the computer and you're just communicating via a terminal, can you tell that it's a computer on the other side of the wall, or is it an actual person?
Wow.
So if you can't tell the difference, then that would qualify in those days as a sort of artificial intelligence.
And so what did you do with this? Like, what would be a practical use of AI, if any, in those days, or was it more kind of experimental?
For me, I was just fooling around.
You're just
fooling around. Trying to copy.
You were a hacker.
I was a hacker trying to copy the kings, and I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot.
Did you ever meet some of those kings later?
I did not, actually. There was a guy I really wanted to meet because the guy that ran this timeshare company was a former CalSpan researcher who had retired and was doing this in his retirement. And he had a book of Frank Rosenblatt's book on perceptrons, which is now pretty much very closely related to deep learning that's going on in AI today.
You're looking at me like I know the book, but go ahead. I'll humor
Sorry,
you.
Okay. Well, this is making me think about things from a long time ago. But anyway, it was just very interesting as to me, how can we emulate intelligence? Actually, I kind of got down on computer software as a medium for AI because I had already peeked behind the curtain. I already kind of knew what was going on there, and I realized that it was just programming and algorithms and wasn't that interesting.
So what made it less interesting for you?
Well, because I already wrote the program. You know, I know what the algorithm was for responding. Same thing happened to me with computer games. I wound up writing some code for computer games, simple computer games in those days, and it just broke the allure of any kind of video game or computer game.
Because you could see what was going on behind the curtain.
Exactly.
And once you knew that, it wasn't that interesting anymore.
That's right. Yeah, so it's kind of demystifies it and takes the fun out of it.
And is it the case that the same underlying kind of, I don't know, explanatory methods or not the same algorithms, but maybe some elements of the same algorithms are in place, the same logic, let's say, today or over time? I mean, of course, it's way more complex, but is it the same thing? At a certain level?
Might even be simpler. In some ways. Yeah, some of the shoot 'em up games that kids play or other kind of more fantasy-oriented games, I think, are even simpler, just in multiplayer. So there actually is a real body on the other side sometimes.
Right. So what got you so interested in technology? I mean, a smart kid growing up in a small town. And did your parents, your father was an engineer and your mom was a stay-at-home mom. Did she go to university?
No, and my dad, my mom did not. She easily could have. She still is a very bright person. But that wasn't the thing in those days.
Exactly.
And my dad wound up going to night school for, I think it must have been 11 years maybe. Mm. I remember going to his college graduation.
Is that right?
Yeah. So it was every evening he would come home and hit the books and work on his courses. And it just dragged out, doing a full bachelor's degree.
Because he was
in
working
the evening.
He was working full time and he needed to make a living. He had to support his family.
Exactly.
And so you were going to school when he was going to school, although you were in high school, I guess. Or
right. Yeah. Well, I was a little younger, but in junior high school.
Yeah. Did you look at his homework? Or did he look
no,
at yours?
No, no.
You could have helped each other.
I remember later there was some professor that was still around when I was at Trinity that had taught my dad a course. And my dad decided that he'd been mistreated by this particular professor and just left a big cloud in my mind for this person. So it was.
And so you met him, actually.
So that person I met, yeah.
And what did you say to this person?
Oh, nothing. I was very polite.
Of course. But you were thinking about it the whole time.
I was thinking about
it. And you were looking at him, talking to him maybe for a short time, I don't know. But you're thinking, did he really do this kind of nasty thing to my dad?
I don't even know if it was a nasty thing.
Well, but, something that stuck with him in any way.
That's right.
So what makes someone get into into coding and into hacking and into kind of artificial intelligence in the very, very early days of kind of modern technology? I mean, why was that your path?
I think it was opportunity. I mean, I was at this Talking Mountain Science Center, and they had these facilities available. It wasn't like a giant place or anything, but they did have all these kind of edgy things. And just having a chance to experience them and play with them was really the draw. I mean, I think that, and this kind of gets into part of my philosophy about education or inventiveness, but I think that when you leave children alone in an unprogrammed environment and they have to kind of create their own thing, whether it's picking up some sticks and pretending they're something else or here's a computer, go have a fun time with it, explore it. That open-ended sort of opportunity is really helps develop creativity far better than programmed learning activities. Like you might see sending kids to, after-school programs. And,
robotics camp and things like this? Depends on how it's done, I suppose.
Yeah, robotics camp, that also depends on how it's done. Yeah. And most of them are actually done pretty well.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about more formal, like taking an extra math class or something in the evening. You see what happens in Korea, for example, with the students are after school. They go to school, and they spend time in school till 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night sometimes. Single day.
These are high school kids.
Right. Even younger.
Even younger. And you think that's not a good way to enhance your creative potential or fulfill what you might have.
It's a great way to get good scores on exams.
Yeah.
Not a good way to be creative.
Very interesting. I was reading something about something that Walt Whitman wrote. And he said something like, if you want to be creative, you have to forget everything you learned in school and in church. And that's not exactly what you're saying, but it's not that far removed either. In your case, you were doing this Saturday program, and that's where you kind of had free rein, and you just were given the opportunity to play with computers, I suppose.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a transformative experience for me.
Yeah.
And it's very closely related to experiential learning, which is something we're very fond of here at Dartmouth and elsewhere.
Yes, that's right, where you kind of grapple with something first, and you make a lot of mistakes, and you learn what you learn. And then afterwards, somebody, a facilitator, might help you draw out some of the insights, maybe tell you some of the theory or ideas behind it.
Get past some of the barriers, perhaps.
Get past some of the barriers, I'm curious that if this Saturday program was focused on biology or chemistry, as opposed to, I don't know if this was physics, but certainly was engineering and computers, computer science.
Actually, it was more of a natural sciences kind of thing. So some kids were attracted to astronomy, which I was too, geology, meteorology, which I spent quite a bit of time studying, launching weather balloons and tracking them and trying to measure.
You did all that?
Wind flow, yes.
Yeah. Why do some people, so this is a slight aside, I have two friends that are, they're not scientists or professors. They do whatever they do, but they are just so fanatical about the weather. And they track this, and they watch this, and they look at this, and they're amateurs, to be sure. And I don't know that I see this kind of deep dive into some area like that. I mean, maybe just odd, you know, sample size of two friends of mine. But now that you said it, you made me think about it. What is it that's so exciting about this?
About the weather?
Yeah.
Well, you know, in California, the weather's not that exciting.
No, it's always the same, right?
Almost. And I don't know, it's just fascinating. It's sort of quantitatively looking at our natural world. And, you know, it changes on a much faster time scale, which is more interesting than, say, watching continents drift or something like that.
That's right. If that's the comparison point, yeah.
Right.
By the way, back to something you said about your dad and the business he started. You were working in the assembly line. Was it a successful business? Did it work out?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't one of these exponential growth businesses that we hear more about today. But it was successful. Put food on the table, I would say it didn't quite send me to college, but it sent my younger sister to college for sure.
Okay.
So,
because it took a bit more time to get going. And,
that's right.
Yeah. So you have one sibling?
Actually, I have two. I have a younger brother who's a mechanical engineer, very talented.
Yeah.
And a much younger sister who's was the one I was referring to.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. And what do they do? Are they also kind of, I don't know, inventors, professors, science oriented? So the brother is to some extent.
My brother definitely is. He's creates unique machines on a custom basis for certain types of manufacturing operations. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has a problem, it's a machine that doesn't actually solve this problem, and he designs a machine to solve that problem and then moves on to the next challenge.
Right. It sounds like once you figure out what's working behind it, sounds like a Fossum family trait here.
Well, I always try to get my brother to like make more than one of something so that he could actually
there's an economic model
that
in there.
But
and your sister, did she go into science or engineering or?
She's more on the medical side.
Yeah.
So she's definitely part of the family in that regard.
Yeah. So okay, you're writing all this software. You went to Trinity and college. You enjoyed college.
Yeah, I wound up majoring in physics, which it turned out I loved, and just fell into it. It came to me very easily. Mm-hmm. And engineering, which was a little bit more computer engineering-related things. So.
Yeah. Did you have any special faculty members that you remember, that you recall?
Oh, I remember Dave Algren, who was a young professor at the time, and now is, I think he's retired now, but still very much about, and still a very good friend and mentor. And he was also let me do a lot of exploring and working with different things.
Yeah. You brought up now a couple of times, you know, almost like your philosophy about inventing, and I was going to ask you about that because you've done it time and again, and not only done it, but I guess you've thought about that process. So let's kind of dig into it a little bit more. Are inventors born or made?
Well, I don't know. I think that I think we're all inventors. We're human beings are naturally creative, and some people, everybody has the potential to invent. I think everybody does invent. They just don't know that they're inventing.
For example,
you think about the old timers that came to this country and out here in the woods of New Hampshire, and come up with problems. They have to find solutions to those problems and wind up inventing techniques or tools or other things to solve those problems, but mm-hmm. Probably didn't think too much that they were an inventor. But I mean, they were just.
But you'd say
they're just getting by and yes. solving things. And I think we all do that all the time.
So anytime we're trying to solve a problem, that's a form of invention, would you say, or only when you solve it in a new way?
Well, so when we're solving it and come up with a solution, mm-hmm. even if it's not the best solution or maybe it doesn't even work at all, you find out soon enough, that is all part of the inventive process. So, you know, being an inventor with a patent means that you're the, at least in a documented way, you're the first person to sure. think of that particular solution for a particular problem. But otherwise, I think it's in all human beings. And we all have the capability to create new things. And it, you know, it's, and I should say that I feel like creativity is the same thing, whether it's in the arts or if it's in engineering mm-hmm. or it's in other fields of science. It's innate to humans, and it's innate to other creatures in the world, too. So, you know, chimpanzees and crows and everything, they also invent tools to accomplish certain things. Mm. So it's maybe it's just part of having a brain bigger than a peanut. You know?
I think a lot of people might be questioning this because they see, most of us see, and maybe I'm wrong too, but we see people going through their lives and it doesn't look like they're inventing very much. They're just right. surviving. They're doing what they need to do.
Yeah, well, I think it depends on the circumstances mm-hmm. and what the necessity is. Mm-hmm. So you're asking if we are born inventors or we're taught to be inventors.
For example.
And I feel that it's part of our instinctual behavior.
Yeah, yeah. And so if it doesn't come out, would you say that's a reasonable premise or not? Like if it doesn't come out implies, well, sometimes it doesn't. And I'm wondering whether you think that's even true. But if it doesn't come out, it's because, you know, your life and your life experiences didn't enable you to fulfill that kind of innate, as you say, the innate.
Or you weren't required to do it. Is another way of looking at it.
You weren't required to do it, but wouldn't you seek out a place if invention is part of your DNA? Wouldn't you seek out a place to exercise that DNA?
Well, you know, again, this goes back to what we were talking about in childhood of whether you have a chance to, if you're like consumed all the time with input, you know, watching TV or playing video games all the time, or whether in fact you have some break time and you have to create your own universe, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think it helps develop some of those talents.
Yeah.
But I think they're still innate.
Mm-hmm. And so when someone has free time, I'll call it free time, and they're not doing anything, you would say that's, like, good. Just let them live and look and see, and eventually they'll try something. Might not work, might not be great, but they'll just do it. As opposed to having, you know, so many people have these scripted lives and kids, the way we bring up kids especially. Is that kind of a central element then to creativity or invention?
Yeah, I mean, all these things are in with certain limits. You wouldn't want to put somebody in a isolation chamber for, you know, a long period of time.
That would be tough.
Right. But, yeah, some playtime, I think. Some free time is a good thing.
What about that 10,000 hours idea? Do you know that one? Malcolm Gladwell popularized it.
10,000 hours before you become an expert.
An expert at something, yeah. Right. And he used Bill Gates as an example. I think he used hockey players or something else as an example. What do you think about that?
Well, I think 10,000 hours of doing something, you better become an expert at it. Even if it's on the assembly line and moving parts,
you better be good at it.
Right.
Or else, you know, what were you doing? Yeah. So another thing people sometimes think about when it comes to invention is that it's kind of like the eureka moment, right? You're walking down the street, eureka, I just thought of it. Or who's the one, was it Einstein that said 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration? You know those.
Yeah, I'm not sure who said it, but I certainly know the saying.
Yeah. Is it true, do you think? Or?
Oh, absolutely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. But I think that there's very few people that are walking down the road and suddenly think of something new that they hadn't been thinking of before or hadn't been challenged with or anything. Mm-hmm. I think those events are more like the, you've already presented with a problem or a challenge, and your subconscious is working on it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And finally bubbles up to your consciousness, and that's when you feel like, oh, eureka, I just had this idea popped into my head.
Right. So you're working on it all the time, whether you know it or not.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and then the eureka moment is almost like a recognition of something that was bubbling up.
Yeah, it's like a little part of your brain starts waving its hand saying, hey, I know the answer to that.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Eric if that was part of the process that led to your work on cameras and some of the great inventions that you've been involved with. We're with Eric Fossum. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to the Sidcast. Every now and then I have a commercial sponsor, and the following commercial is brought to you by your kids. Let me play. Let me explore. Don't tell me what I should do all the time. And definitely don't do my homework for me. You know, when I'm a bit older and I'm applying to college, whatever you do, don't write my applications for me. Let me play. This commercial is brought to you from your kids.
We're back with Eric Fossum on the Sidcast. We've been talking to Eric about his life a little bit and about invention and innovation and creativity and where it comes from. And I wanted to pick up this segment by going back to that theme on invention. And so, you know, imagine you're the king and the king decrees, I want more invention in my kingdom. What would the king do to make that happen?
Well, I like the idea of being king. But, you know, I have had this really positive experience. I'm a member of the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and the National Inventors Hall of Fame does a program for elementary school kids called Camp Invention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like runs for a week in the summertime, and the kids come to school, and we try to help them kind of discover their inner inventor in this process. Mm. And it's kind of a STEM-related program, but there's no formal teaching, really. The kids come in, and one day they might be disassembling stuff that you would normally find around the house, electronics or other things, and looking inside things and seeing how they work.
Might get in trouble at home doing it, but it's...
That's right, yeah. It's a destructive thing, but it's got to be donated stuff that parents know is being taken apart. But satisfying that kind of curiosity about what's inside here. And what can I do with little pieces I just took out of the DVD player and what are they good for? Others are more structured, where there's actual... things that they try to create, problems that they try to solve with materials that are, and for Camp Invention, they come in a box, so they try to solve it with this curriculum in a box. But they, solve like smart houses or robot dogs or other things. Or even, I remember visiting one camp where they had to do stomp rockets and land the rocket, it's kind of an air stomp, launch this rocket into the air, and it goes 20 feet and lands, try to land it in a pool, which was the calling the moon, right? And so I remember this girl, she had built a rocket. It was like decorating a plastic bottle, really. But she put feathers and other streamers on it and everything. And she put it on the stomp. She stomped it, and it went flying and didn't make it very far. She picked it up and she looked at it and she said, oh, it's got too much stuff on it. I need to take away some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so she took a couple of things off, put it back on, and blammo, went right into the middle of this pool.
Landed.
So, here was like, it was an experiential learning sort of thing where she figured out that the reason why it didn't go was, I think she didn't call it air resistance or anything, but that's what it was, right? And then she solved the problem.
Right.
And basically giving... people, a creative environment where they can try things out and don't feel bad about failing, where they can try and try again. I mean, sometimes something is just a bad idea and you should give it up. But trying again in a safe way where you're not judged, it's not like regular school where you better get the right answer the first time.
No grades here in Camp Invention.
That's right. And so I think that process is, I mean, the kids are like all excited. They're just, you know, a randomly distributed group of kids in the summer, but they all come away extremely excited and big changes in their attitude towards STEM learning as well, just by having this creative, safe experience in Camp Invention. Right. So
are they, so are these gifted kids? Or just any old kids that want to go to this thing?
Well, every kid is gifted, but they're...
That is a really good answer. Thank you, Eric.
But they're just kids that...
They're just kids.
They or their parents are, or both, hopefully, are interested in this opportunity and get a chance to go. So,
if someone listening wanted to know about Camp Invention for their kids, I guess they could Google that. Is that the...
Google Camp Invention, yeah. It's part of the National Inventors Hall of Fame, and hopefully there's a camp... In next summer or near them.
There are multiple camps around the country?
There's like 1,500 camps around the country.
1,500?
That's right.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great program.
That's fantastic. So what happens when they go back to regular school?
Well, so I don't have personal experience, but what I've heard teachers say is that, because by the way, there's a secret to Camp Invention.
Uh-huh.
And the secret is that we're also teaching teachers who work at Camp Invention how to teach STEM and creativity to kids.
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of elementary school teachers don't know how to do this.
Really?
So they get experience at teaching it. They get to take the materials back to the classroom. So the teachers are energized. The kids are energized anyway, mm-hmm. even from this short experience over the summer. And it seems to be, it has been running enough years, maybe 20 years, to know really whether it's going to create a whole new generation of inventors or not.
Mm.
But I think it's a pretty good experience, even if that's not the case.
Absolutely. It's an experience just in that moment for those kids to do that. Although the data analyst in me wonders, have you guys been tracking this? So you could see, and compare it to some other group and higher percentage going to college, higher percentage going to STEM, this type of thing.
Right. Yeah, I think the some of the analytics that are done kind of ad hoc are very positive.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally believable. Can we replicate anything like that in schools? Let's talk about universities, because we live in a university world here at Dartmouth. And I think about what, say, our students in the business school do, and they go to class, they go to another class. It's not a lot of time in between. This is, there's not a lot of time in between. We talk about reflection being important. We talk about it all the time. We don't give them a lot of time to do that. Is there a lot of room for experimentation? Again, I'm kind of nodding, shaking my head a little. I'm not so sure. But maybe you do better in engineering, where you live and breathe this thing. But I mean, how do we do this? How do we keep it going?
Well, certainly in the arts, it's very experiential. Students, play music or create music visual arts.
Yeah.
In engineering, students do creative projects, solving problems mm-hmm. As part of their coursework,
mm-hmm.
And work in teams to solve problems, so they get that experience that way, and most of them love that experience.
Mm-hmm.
The business side, things that we're doing in the entrepreneurial program, both at Tuck and in the Magnuson Center for Entrepreneurship,
yep.
are very experiential. Kids or young adults mm-hmm. are learning about entrepreneurship in a safe environment. They can mm-hmm. kind of work on a business plan and...
Right.
Many of these will not really turn into anything, or the student mm-hmm. goes on to something else later. But it gives them that experience, that firsthand experience. They work through all the problems and the issues of how to create a new enterprise and all the elements that have to go mm-hmm. into that, plus the teamwork and the emotional IQ part of it, as well as the regular IQ part. So I think that happens in Tuck, and I think it happens here mm-hmm. on campus also.
Right. The key elements in, say, adult education, or how adults learn, is you gotta have a body of knowledge or content or insights. You have to have some grappling with that, or experimenting with that, or playing with that, and you gotta have feedback and lots of it. And they don't have to go in that order, of course. And so I think what you're talking about, Eric, is these experiential activities. You're doing that experience first. And you're making those mistakes. It's like the little girl that, has too much stuff on that rocket. Better take something off and see what happens. And then maybe later, I don't know that she's necessarily going to get a lecture on air resistance, but in college you might get that lecture or you might learn a little bit more.
And you connect the experience that you had to what you're learning about, and it helps also, kind of puts a picture in your mind to whatever it is you're talking about.
And what about feedback? So in real life, there's a ton of feedback. If something works, it doesn't. And in business, people are very quick to tell you. In school, we have feedback, but I think it's actually quite limited in my view. What do you think?
Well, again, I think that the feedback is basically grading. We have to assess how well we think the student has mastered the material.
Yeah, I mean, that's after
the
fact.
As an instructor, it's always hesitant to really, because it's how can you tell whether a student has mastered it or not, except to have them
do it, do something with it,
repeat it back to you or something, and see if they can do it. Experiential learning, though, on the other hand, that is real feedback, right? You go to create an engineering project and you make it, and it solves the problem or it doesn't solve the problem, or it solves the problem but it could be better. And you get that feedback like, this is works, but it's going to be super expensive. So, how can you accomplish the same thing but with a smaller or less costly bill of materials? Things like that. So it's feedback, but it's not like from a person to a person. It's almost like self-discovered feedback.
Right, right. So, Eric, back to you. After Trinity, you went, directly for a PhD?
I went directly to Yale and worked on a PhD there. I wasn't actually sure I was going to do a PhD at Yale. My fiancé at the time was a year behind me at Trinity, and so I was just trying to stay in the Connecticut orbit while I...
That's true. They're not that far apart.
Yep. And then... But I loved it. I really had such a good time at Yale. Graduate school was like the best time of my life.
Really?
Practically. Yeah.
So what made it so great?
I think it was just that I got to do all this fun stuff for 4 years or 5 years of, it's like, wake up, what do I need to do next tomorrow? And do it and execute it and learn something along the way and discover new problems and work on solving those problems. And, I was like a pig in my pen. I was just so happy.
I'm trying to extrapolate a little bit from that to people that are not, say, in science or getting a PhD program, whatever they're doing. What are the key elements that would make them so happy doing whatever they're doing? So it's of course, they have to have fun with it. They probably look at it as fun more than work, I would think.
Has to be interesting.
Has to be fascinating to them.
Right.
Right. They feel like they're accomplishing something that they care about.
Right. And part of that is the feedback that you get, even from your own self-directed work.
Yeah. It's a fantastic thing when people have that. I've had it in my own, not just education, but a lot of my career. Many others have too, but many others do not. It reminds me of, the assembly line story you shared earlier. So it's we're looking at the world a little bit differently, and I know that. But my wish is for everyone to have that type of career, or at least as much as you possibly can, and to find that type of job, that type of calling almost. It's a calling, where it's not work. It is work, but it's not work. Because you said when we first started talking, I think you said something like you were working the weekend. This past weekend, and work, but you loved it. You still love it.
Well, there are other things I wouldn't mind doing with my time too, but I still love
it. Which you do, I think. Which you do. Okay, so we're back in Yale. You got your PhD, and then you went to Columbia?
I taught at Columbia.
For how many years?
It was about 6 years in total.
6 years, and is that after that that you went to Caltech?
Yeah, in about my fifth year or something, JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is a NASA laboratory, which is operated by Caltech in Pasadena, California, recruited me to come work on problems they were having in cameras and spacecraft, which by that time, that element at the heart of every camera, the part that receives light and turns it into electrical signals. It's called an image sensor, an electronic chip. That had become my specialty by the time I was at Columbia, even at Yale. And so they wanted me to come and work on problems they were having with this sensor at the heart of all these NASA spacecraft cameras. So I always wanted to work in the space program and excited about science and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, it sounded like a dream job.
Well, I mean, I was born in 1957, which was in the same month of Sputnik.
Wow.
Not that I was aware of it, of course, but, you know, it just seems like my life has been in sequence with the whole space program. So I grew up watching all those Mercury, Gemini, Apollo missions and landing on the moon and all that sort of thing. And the chance to be involved in a space program, which has been my dream as a child, but when I got older, I didn't, you know, I'm doing working on electronics. Who would, what does that have to do with the space program? And suddenly having this, it's like the key fitting into the lock.
It had a lot to do with the space program.
Yeah, it turned out to have a lot to do.
So what did you do? So you worked on the camera, but one particular aspect of it, right?
Right. Yeah. So this electronic device, that device was called a charge coupled device, CCD, which was the basis of most of our cameras in those days. You remember those big camcorders that you would carry around with a big battery?
It was,
I had like a brick battery on the back that would last for like half an hour or something like that. Yeah, so it was kind of a bulky camera technology, and because of the way the CCD operates, it would require a lot of power to operate and a bulky camera. And that was true in NASA spacecraft cameras too, even
they
more
had
so.
They have these
big bulky cameras the size of a small refrigerator or something with all the electronics
payload.
In it.
Wow.
And that would all add to payload mass and volume and power. I mean, what happens when you're far away from the sun? Where does the power come from?
Right.
Unless you bring along your own little nuclear generator, it's you're out of luck if
so
you
this
need
is
a lot
serious,
of power.
This is a serious problem.
Yeah, actually, it's worse. It's in space. There's a lot of cosmic radiation, and this cosmic radiation can basically is like a wear out mechanism for electronics. So they start to fail, and so who wants to have a spacecraft travel for years and years and years to Saturn or something, and you turn the camera on, and oops, it's worn out on the journey. Mm. So there's a lot of concerns about this, and so we were thinking about, how do we go about changing the technology so that it will last longer? And, in fact, the head of NASA for all of NASA missions was saying, hey, we got to do things faster, better, and cheaper. And that was, you know, from rockets all the way down to electronics. Mm. All those things were true.
Right.
So that was kind of the problem that I faced that led to, you know, having to be creative with a new kind of solution.
So what was that new kind of solution?
I came up with this slightly different way to skin the cat. It was called complementary metal oxide semiconductor, which was abbreviated CMOS or CMOS.
CMOS,
which is the recipe that's used by most mainstream microelectronics anyway. So the CCD was not in the mainstream recipe. That meant you couldn't mix a lot of other electronics on the same chip. So you'd have separate electronics, and that was part of the bulkiness problem. So if we could do everything in CMOS, we would have a camera on a chip. And so once we figured out how to make a good image sensor in a CMOS process, we were able to make this camera on a chip and put all the electronics on the same chip as the little pixels, the light-sensitive pixels, and shrink the size of the camera. So that
shrink it to how big are we talking about now?
Well, it depends if you include the lenses or not. Mm. But at the time, I thought we could make it the size of about a gambling die, you know, maybe a centimeter by centimeter by centimeter, something like that. And then these days, make it even much smaller, 10 times at least smaller than that. So it's gone from that big camcorder you would carry around Now you could do recording right off of your iPhone.
Off the iPhone easily. That's right. So the camera, and I'm lifting up my iPhone here, my cell phone. The camera here, do you have something to do with that?
Yeah, that uses my technology.
That uses your technology. Everyone who's listening to this podcast on their phones, they're carrying your technology on that phone.
Yeah, probably. There's at least two cameras, one front-facing, one rear-facing.
Right.
They both use CMOS image sensor chips, those cameras. They're used in not only there, but they're used in regular cameras these days. They're used in automobiles. They're used in little pills that you might swallow to take a look at your small intestines.
Pills. They're in there, too.
So they're really pretty ubiquitous. In fact, there's about 5 billion cameras made every year now using that CMOS image sensor technology.
That you invented?
That use my invention, yes.
Wow. 5 billion a year?
5 billion per year, yeah.
Right, that's better than McDonald's.
Right. Actually, another statistic, fun fact, is that people upload about maybe 10 billion pictures in total across the planet every day through the internet.
Mm.
10 billion pictures uploaded.
And that couldn't happen without these tiny cameras with this quality.
Yeah, and as I like to joke, about half of them are pictures of cats, maybe. But
so that's but another course, way to skin the cat. There you go. You went full circle on that. Wow. So you invented this CMOS technology for cameras.
That's called CMOS image sensor.
Image sensor. When you were employed by Caltech Jet Propulsion Lab.
So we were working under contract to NASA, but I was an employee of Caltech. That's correct.
So you know where I'm going with this question.
Yeah, keep going.
That's okay. Great. Does Caltech get all of the royalties after all this time of $5 billion a year of these cameras?
More or less, yes. But, I'm not privy to the deals that they cut. But the first people that or company that Caltech licensed this new technology was the company we started.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I tried as a government employee to get a lot of U.S. companies interested in this technology. But there were no takers because CCDs were mainstream and they were all being done in Japan and it just wasn't part of American industry. And it was like, hey, you guys, we ought to be doing this, right? This is taxpayer-funded research results.
You're right. And they said no?
Just generally not interested.
Who were this? Did you talk to them directly?
It's places like Motorola and Intel and National Semiconductor.
Top places.
Yeah, top places.
And they said, why did they say no?
Well, that is a mystery for sure. But from a business point of view, I think they were busy doing other things, and they weren't sure about the ecosystem. The Japanese own the ecosystem also. So there are a lot of hard things that you would have to do to get started in this business. It wasn't they weren't interested. They thought it was kind of a cool idea, but just didn't fit into their current business plans.
So is that why you started your own company?
Well, actually, even Kodak... Kodak was interested. The engineers were interested.
Because they got it. They understood it.
Right. But higher up, they weren't so sure. And, of course, they were chemists. Kodak thought of itself as a chemical company.
Yes.
So that should have been a home run, but was not.
Kodak could have owned, I don't know about owned, but that would have had a license.
They could have leapfrogged everybody else.
And they'd have these little cameras on my phone. They'd have that technology.
Right. Interestingly enough, the self-contained digital camera was also invented at Kodak. And Kodak also wasn't interested in pursuing that.
The self-contained digital...
Kind of what we think about is a digital camera these days. A DSLR or something like that.
They invented that.
Steve Sesson invented that,
An engineer.
A fellow member of the National Inventors Hall of Fame. So I've heard his stories.
I can imagine sitting around with a beer at the end of the day at one of your conferences talking stories. Oh my God.
Yeah. It was great to have those conversations with inventors. But so it's not an uncommon problem, by the way.
Yeah,
so anyway, we finally decided to start our own company, Photobit. My wife and I started it. She was a fellow engineer also working with my group. mm-hmm. at JPL. And we didn't know what the heck we were doing. But fortunately, we did okay.
I guess so. Do you still have that business? Is that one of the things in your portfolio these days? Because I know you've done a bunch of startups along the way.
Yeah, well, this was my first one, aside from my Paperoot.
Paperoot was the first startup, yeah. Okay.
Photobit lived for about 6 years before it was acquired by Micron, which is a big semiconductor company in Boise, Idaho.
Did you go to Micron originally and see if they wanted this idea the way you did the Motorola and National Semiconductor?
No, Micron wasn't on that early list of companies.
Okay.
That
I was just looking for additional irony, but that's okay.
Yeah, no, there was no particular irony there, but Micron was a memory chip company, mm-hmm. and so we thought there were a lot of synergies there, and yeah. there were. And in fact, Micron went on to become the world's largest producer of CMOS image sensors for cell phones for quite a few years.
Who does this today?
Mostly Samsung and Sony. Say Sony's number one, Samsung is number two.
And how did they get the technology? Do they also license this?
Well, they just started copying it.
Copying it?
And
I'm shocked.
Yeah, terrible. Who would have thought, guessed?
Yeah.
And then eventually, after Photobit had been acquired, mm-hmm. And there was a number of arrangements, but then Caltech asserted their ownership of that IP against all these big giant companies and settled with all of them.
They settled with Caltech.
Right.
So they kept on producing and selling this, but Caltech would get some cut of all of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably Caltech just got an upfront lump sum.
Right, whatever the terms were. Do you have any sense of how much value was created from this invention?
You mean from a Dollar Caltech's point of view?
If you know Caltech, but cause that might be public, I don't know. But just because they're $5 billion a year, it's been going on for a long time. Your first startup was acquired. You had other startups.
Do you want to include places like Facebook that are like, based on people sharing pictures that they take with their phones or Instagram?
That's a very good question.
It's a huge number.
Anyway, you cut it, it's in the billions to tens of billions to hundreds of billions, depending on what definition you
have. It's kind of mind-blowing. It's
you couldn't have imagined it would be this big. Come on.
Nope, I did not at all. And there are many things that applications I didn't imagine. And some I did, but it's like a life of its own. And just to be honest, I mean, so we have the invention, I created the first idea, but the bringing the technology to the point where it is today mm-hmm. is really the work of thousands of engineers around the world that have worked on this for many years. So it's also to their credit that absolutely. This has become such a ubiquitous technology.
Right, absolutely. And what about NASA? Let's go back to where it all started.
Yeah, so NASA is a very conservative organization, but I think in Mars 2020, which is a mission that's coming up, they'll be using a lot of CMOS cameras in that.
They haven't been using it in the last couple of years. There was one not that long ago to Pluto, I think, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah, believe it or not, they tend to been using CCDs for those scientific
instruments.
Those giant
things that I...
Yeah, all those things that had all those warts, they continue to have warts. And, you know, I understand it as a taxpayer. When you going to do the next mission, whatever mission you're on, number 22, and you're going to do number 23,
right.
You have a choice. You can either take a camera that has already been used for 22 missions successfully and use it in your mission, or you can try this new technology that no one's used before on a NASA mission.
Mm.
And by the way, it's going to take a lot of taxpayer money to do this. And it's going to take years of your life to propose the mission. It's going to take years of your life to build the instrument. And it's going to take years to wait while the spacecraft is flying to Pluto or wherever. And then they're going to turn it on to take a picture. Now, are you going to risk taking something that hasn't been tried before? Mm. We're going to go with those that technology that has the 22 successes legacy.
Right, right.
You've
explained it well. It's so much boils down to organizational processes, politics, systems, and leadership.
That's right.
Really amazing how much, even when it comes to kind of this world-breaking technology, they don't automatically get used. Even when you went to Motorola and the others and they said no, and you said, well, that's like the question. Why did they say no? But I'm sure there were all kinds of internal things going on, other projects going on in-house. There's a bit of risk, maybe a lot of risk to doing something new. I think it's the lesson of modern technology and business. Not being willing to take on those seemingly crazy risks means usually the end of your company when others do it and do it better.
That's right. I think when you're large, you become risk adverse.
Yeah.
And so like the European Space Agency flew a lot of cameras in space.
Oh, they did.
With the CMOS technology already. Yeah, so they had a lot less to lose, basically, and didn't have this big machine and legacy to deal with.
So you won the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering just in 2017 based on this invention and maybe related inventions, I would take it, right? And that's kind of like a Nobel Prize, isn't it, in engineering, something like this?
A lot of people consider it the Nobel Prize of engineering because there's no Nobel decided there shouldn't be a prize for engineering among his in his legacy. He didn't consider engineering to be high enough on the ladder of endeavors to...
And actually, there's nothing on leadership, just so you know.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so it was great. And it was for digital creation of digital imaging sensors and went to several of us. The inventors of the CCD were included. And from... CC when it was invented in 1969, and also Nobu Taranishi, who did work on CCDs when they were being developed a lot in Japan in the late 70s, early 80s, was another co-recipient.
Right, very exciting. And you know, your career has been, and I think continues to be, unbelievably successful. But I want to ask you, if you ever wonder or think about some other track, some other career track you may have gone on with the same skill set that you wonder, you know, I could have done that. Not that you regret it, that you didn't do that, but I'm curious because, I'm curious about that.
Well, first of all, and you'll hear many inventors and successful people say this, I just will say it also, it's, you know, it's not just having the right invention. It's having the right invention at the right time and at the right circumstances. Yeah. Luck is such a huge part of success that it's hard to explain to people that, you know, it's good to be prepared and ready to take advantage of situations, but just a lot of factors you can't control and can't hope to control that lead to success.
Right.
So could have easily have done all the same things and, it died. You know, it was another NASA research effort that didn't go anywhere.
But, you know, let's not forget that you and your wife actually became entrepreneurs, created something.
That's true. And it was part of the fact that, you know, we had created this new technology. And it's like having a child. You want to nurture it and see it grow. And you're not going to just, like, let it
die. You were probably getting frustrated. Nobody was picking this up.
Oh, very frustrated.
Very.
Very frustrated. So, yes.
Wow. So if you can go back to talk to your 21-year-old self magically, what advice, what story, what would you tell your 21-year-old, the 21-year-old Eric Fossum from the vantage point of where you are today?
I'm not sure I would believe myself, but... I mean, I think, you know, at that age, you are you don't really know how things are going to work out and some anxiety about whether you're going to be successful or even be able to support yourself or have the same things that you grew up with and be able to go back and tell myself it's all going to work out, take a chill pill, it's going to work. That'd probably be the number one thing I would want to tell myself.
Yeah, just... calm down, relax, step by step, it'll work out.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned your wife was your business partner as well.
Yes, she's my former wife, actually.
Your former wife. So, and you worked with her in business for those 6 years?
Five of those six years.
Are you married now?
I'm remarried.
Remarried. Where did you meet your partner?
In Southern California.
Where the sun always shines.
Where the sun always shines.
Can you tell us a story about how you met?
Well, it was through a mutual friend, and
like a fix-up.
Yeah, well, not even a fix-up. It was more of an introduction. And,
yeah.
Had a lot of things in common, interests, and yeah, it was good. I mean, she was and still is. You know, she grew up in Southern California, so transplanting her here to New Hampshire was a big move.
That's a big move.
Yeah.
I did that move because my wife and I lived for 6 years in L.A. before coming up to Hanover, New Hampshire.
Right, so it's almost the same thing. As she grew up in Orange County. And,
yeah.
She really likes it up here, and fits right in.
That's a good thing. I think I'll consider it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. Would you say, Eric, that you're today happy?
Oh, I'm very happy. I have a new granddaughter who was born just
wonderful.
I don't know, 9 weeks ago, maybe.
9 weeks ago, a little baby.
Yeah, a little baby. So I have three three wonderful natural daughters and a great stepdaughter, stepson. So it's a big family all of a sudden.
Right.
But yeah, it's.
Do they ever ask you about some of these stories about, you know, the research you did and what? Because they're all.
Well,
anyone
actually,
has their, they have their
yeah,
phones.
Yeah, yeah, they do. So my oldest daughter, who got a PhD from Stanford, wound up working for Instagram as a data scientist. And as far as I know, she still hasn't told anybody at Instagram what her dad did.
That's funny.
She doesn't want to.
Does she have your last name?
It's her middle name now, but yeah. Not that anyone would recognize my last name, but
maybe not. But there's always some science geek that.
So
would.
That's kind of funny. And my other two daughters grew up with Sabrina and I talking around the kitchen table about PhotoBit all the time. Every evening, the discussion was about PhotoBit because it was like a chance to digest the day. And my kids would always be like, "Stop talking about PhotoBit," and. So, yeah, they grew up with it, and I think, you know, they appreciate it, but it's...
Did they go in another direction in terms of their own career? Are they growing up now?
Yeah, so my middle daughter is just getting her PhD right now in atmospheric science. And,
there's a pattern I'm beginning to see here.
Yeah, my youngest daughter did an undergraduate degree in geology, another scientist, which I never expected, so... Even when we try not to have much influence on our kids, we still wind up influencing them anyway.
Yeah, this gets us to where we started talking about you growing up and your own parents. And while they didn't have advanced degrees, to be sure, you mentioned your mom, stay-at-home mom, was very smart, and your dad probably as well, and certainly was an entrepreneur.
Right. And by the way, before I get in trouble, my mom did go on to run the housing authority in the town that...
Okay. There you go. We got that on record.
Yes, good.
We got that on record. It's just very interesting to think about, you know, the impact of parents. And, you know, you talk to a lot of parents and they're telling them, especially if they have teenage kids, they're telling them, you know, it's like goes in one ear, out the other, and they never have any impact, et cetera. But, you know, I think there's some one part of that brain that kind of absorbs it all. And as much as they might try to expel it, it's sticking in there. And there's a time when it starts to come out.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, Eric Fossum, thank you so much for being with us on the Sidcast, and thanks for a great chat.
Thank you very much, Sid. It's been great.